Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 22nd annual Yom HaShoah Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration takes place this coming Monday evening at a time when the American Jewish community is experiencing near historic levels of anti-Semitism, according to the Anti-Defamation League. Assaults, harassment, and vandalism have all increased in recent years, and of course, there have been two shootings in the past 12 months. In October at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and the Shabbat Synagogue shooting just last week in Southern California. The special guest for this year's commemoration is appropriate for this backdrop. Abraham Foxman is the former longtime director of the Anti-Defamation League. He spent over 50 years with the organization. He's now the national director emeritus. He currently is the head of the Center for the Study of Anti-Semitism at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York. Foxman was also a hidden child during the Holocaust. Born in Poland in 1940, he was saved by his Catholic nursemaid, baptized and raised as Catholic during the war years. He reunited with his parents after the war, but 14 members of his family were lost. He'll be speaking about his own story, Survival in the Shadows, Hidden Children of the Holocaust, but he will no doubt address the current climate of anti-Semitism in America today during the commemoration. I spoke with Abraham Foxman last month, prior to the shooting in Poway this past Saturday. Abraham Foxman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
You'll be speaking about the hidden children of the Holocaust, many children during the Holocaust who were taken in by others in Nazi-occupied territory and saved. In fact, you're going to tell us a story of one, Henrik Stanislav Karpi. Why is that child important?
Well, that's my pseudonym. That's about me. I've been asked to share my experiences. I guess the further away we move from the Holocaust, numbers become insignificant. You know, 6 million, what does it mean? How do you focus? How do you understand? And I guess we're going back to the individual. You know, the story of Anne Frank is significant because you can identify and see a person, a human being, rather than a number. And so the organizers of the commemoration said to me, would you talk about your experiences and relate them to what it means? So that's what I will be doing, which I was very, very lucky. 1.5 million Jewish children perished. I survived. That's through miracles, but the miracle is also a human being. And Henrik Stanislav Karpi was Henrik, is my name was Abraham Henry. Stanislav was my patron saint that my nanny gave me, and Karpi was her name. And it was under that identity and the Catholic faith that she hid me and protected me for 4 years. My parents miraculously survived, and we were reunited. So, you know, I will be telling the story. Because the lesson and the message is very profound. It goes beyond me and the experience. It is the difference that an individual can make. One person standing up, saying no, hate, to prejudice, to bigotry, to racism, to anti-Semitism, can save another world, can save a human being. And I think, you know, every single day we have opportunities to stand up to say no. Hopefully I can communicate how significant, how powerful is that God-given gift to stand up and say no.
Many of the hidden children of the Holocaust were hidden away. Was that the experience for you, or because you took this different name, you were...
No, we were actually hidden away, yeah, because the Germans caught up with our family in the city of Vilnius, which is the capital of Lithuania. The Jews were ordered into the ghettos. And Bronislava Karpi was my nanny, and she said to my parents, listen, this will take a couple of days, a couple of weeks. I'll take care of them, you know, and then you come back and we'll be reunited. And nobody, you know, anticipated it would be 4 years, et cetera. So hidden because she had to hide my real identity. I was circumcised, so that made it also a problem, and to protect me from neighbors who weren't friendly. And so hidden children basically represent those who were hidden from the Nazis, from the neighbors, and protected with false identities. in hiding. Some really were hidden in basements and sewers, et cetera, and on farms, and others just had a hidden, different identity. So, yeah, she gave me, as I indicated, a new name, a new faith, and a new identity to protect me.
What were the sort of memories that have stayed with you of that time that have always been with you? Was it...
It's very, very difficult to be able to differentiate that which is, in fact, actual memory or that things that have been told to me. So I'm fortunate. Most hidden children, their parents perished. They have no way of identifying, confirming what their memories are or aren't. With me, you know, the good news is my parents survived, and so they filled in a lot of the gaps. But when you ask me the question, you know, what are my actual memories? I'm not sure. I'm not sure they're actual memories or they were things that were told to me that now become part of my memory bank.
You were very young at the time. How old were you at the time?
I was a year and 3 months when she took me. I was five and a half when we were reunited. And then 6 when I, you know, eventually went with my parents.
Yeah. Came to the United States at that point?
No. The story was beautiful, but it was a somewhat bittersweet. My nanny, who risked her life to save me after the war, said I belonged to her and the Catholic Church.
Ah.
And my parents had a custody battle under the Soviets. The Soviets ruled I belonged to my parents. And so we were repatriated because the Soviets permitted people to go back to the place where they came from as long as it was in the Soviet Empire. So we came from Poland. I was born in Poland. And so from Lithuania, we went back to Poland. So did my nanny. And then I was kidnapped. My parents kidnapped me back. And we smuggled the borders to get out of Poland and wound up in Austria in the American occupied zone for 4 years. Waiting for our quota and visa to come to the U.S. And in 1950, we came to the U.S.
That must have been a traumatic experience because your nanny would probably be the caregiver you knew the most.
Yeah, she was my mother, and my mother I eventually got to know as my aunt. So, you know, who knows? I'm sure it's had its impact, but thank God I can talk about it.
Was it difficult to begin talking about your own story?
It's a very interesting question. I guess it wasn't, because I didn't realize for a long time that I was speaking in third person. It was as if I was telling a story, but it wasn't about me. And therefore, it was relatively easy until about 30 years ago. We had organized a conference of hidden children, and I was asked to keynote it. And all of a sudden, I panicked because for the first time, I was facing an audience that was real, that was like me. So all of a sudden, it came to me that I was speaking in third person and not in first person. That was the first time I really spoke in first person because I was communicating to those who had lived through what I had lived through. So I guess that was the breaking moment. So it is cathartic in a certain way, hopefully inspirational in another way. So today it's not traumatic, it's not difficult. Hopefully, you know, there's a message that will make a difference and therefore makes it that much easier.
You must have a complicated relationship with that nanny because, you know, obviously she fell in love with you and in her own way wanted to keep you after the war.
It was very complicated, Rich, because, she loved me so much to risk her life to save me, okay, and then to fight to keep me. And I remember, you know, when I grew up and tried to understand a little bit more what I had lived through, I asked my father, if she loved me so much, so why all this anger and, if you will, even hate? And he said to me, everything in excess in life is no good. Too rich, too poor, too smart, too stupid, too beautiful, too ugly, too tall, too short, whatever. Too much love. And an excess of love can turn, you know, the other way. So it was painful, more painful, because I never had closure. I never said goodbye. You know, I never thanked her.
Yeah,
because
no.
We fled. And eventually my parents found her and for many years sent packages and money to her on a monthly basis, which she never acknowledged except that she had to sign because it was receipt. You know, you had to sign your name in order to accept it. And then in the late 50s, we got a message from the postal authorities that the person is no longer alive and not to send anything else. So there was really never closure. I do have pictures. You know, interestingly enough, my father smuggled out pictures of her when we were smuggling the borders. And again, I asked him many years later, you know, if the Soviets found these pictures, that means we had a history in Europe, in Poland. Why did you do it? And he said to me, I wasn't sure whether you would remember her, and I wanted to make sure that for the rest of your life you saw the image of her face and of her. And so, you know, thankfully, I do have photos of her, of the two of us, and that's you know, the only treasure I have. And as I indicated, the memories are a little murky.
My guest today is Abraham Foxman. He is the National Director Emeritus of the Anti-Defamation League. Currently, he's been working at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York as the head of their Center for the Study of Anti-Semitism. And he'll be the guest speaker for the 22nd Annual Yom HaShoah Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration, Monday, May 6th at 7 o'clock at Temple Israel. He'll be speaking on survival in the shadows, hidden children of the Holocaust, and telling his own story. And this is one of the great stories of the Holocaust. Families, nannies, neighbors, employees often taking in the children of Jewish families and hiding them during this terrible, terrible time.
And the church too, Rich.
Yes.
The church had a role. I was baptized, you know, given false certificates, etc. So in certain places, the church was very courageous, and other places it wasn't. But the church is part. There were orphanages, Catholic orphanages in France and in other places, which hid Jewish children throughout the war.
Do we have an idea of how many children were saved through the courageous nature of people who said...
Rich, sadly, not enough, but, you know, every single one is a life in a world of its own. There are no statistics. Also, because in most of the cases, the parents did not survive. Okay, so had my parents perished, you and I would not have been talking. You would know that I survived. You would know that I was a hidden child. So many children who were hidden to this day don't know they were hidden. To this day do not know that they were Jewish. They just don't know. And so when you look at the want to know statistics, they're not there. The other thing is, you know, the church itself was not willing to release records because that meant that these Catholic children, now Catholic, would return to Judaism. And they were not interested in that either. So there are no statistics. My feeling is a lot more than we know. And also I would say that Poland, which was the place of the greatest killing, was probably also the place of the greatest saving. But, you know, even to this day, a story surfaces here and there where, on the deathbed, you know, the people who risk their life to save the Jewish child will tell them that they're Jewish. But mostly they don't. So we'll never know. We'll never know the number. We'll never know, you know, what heroism was there, to what extent. But, You know, as long as we know that there were good people who were ready to risk their life to save somebody because there was another human being, you know, that's important enough a lesson for me.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you, you know, you've spent your entire adult life fighting against anti-Semitism. I have to ask you about the level of anti-Semitism in this country today. You know, it's never left. It's always been there. It's sometimes deeper in the shadows than it seems to be now. And certainly we're seeing a rise of the level of the willingness to openly speak in anti-Semitic themes today. What was your sense of this?
I think you're right on target. I don't think there is more today than there was. It was always there. You know, we talk about the Charlottesville 200. The Charlottesville 200 were not created by the last election or by, you know, recently. They were always there. They were anti-Semites. They were bigots. But they stayed in the shadows. They stayed in, if you will, in the sewers, you know. And then what has happened in the last several years is almost removing a firewall. And throughout the years, after Auschwitz was laid bare and we didn't create a vaccine against anti-Semitism and prejudice and racism, so we know it's here. It exists. But we did try to find ways to contain it, to make it unacceptable, to make it un-American, immoral, un-Christian, that even though our Constitution, which permits us to be bigots, you know, we'll even fight for your right to be a bigot or an anti-Semite. On the other hand, what our society has developed is mostly a social contract that, yeah, you can be a bigot, you can be an anti-Semite, but if you are, there will be consequences. No, you won't sit in prison necessarily. But if you're in business, you won't succeed. If you're in politics, you won't make it far. If you're in entertainment or whatever, you won't, you know, Mel Gibson, you know, went from the height all the way down because his anti-Semitism surfaced. So we have developed, especially in this country, this containment of people knowing, yeah, you can be. But it doesn't pay. It's not what America is all about. And then a couple of things happened. And what happened was the taboos started being removed. And it became okay to say all kinds of things about all kinds of people. We had a political campaign which tore down some of the taboos. The internet became an instrument of a superhighway permitting bigotry, racism, anti-Semitism to travel anonymously in nanoseconds globally, and all of a sudden it became more acceptable, more okay to act out the prejudice and the anti-Semitism. So basically, Rich, what you're saying is it's not new. It's always been there. But all of a sudden it's more public. It's more acceptable. It's more tolerated. And I think we need to use every bully pulpit that we have to contain it again, to build that firewall. Because, you know, it's not only anti-Semitism. It's racism. It's Islamophobia. It's against LGBT. Hate does not operate in a vacuum. It usually, you know, starts with one and is hateful of another. Rick, when I finished my term at the ADL after 50 years, I got a lot of questions were asked. What's the most significant thing that you did or you accomplished in all the years in the ADL? And you know, it took me a while, you know, to come up one or two, but one that stands out in my mind and relates to what's happening now, and that is many years ago, and you know, I remember when I was in Oklahoma City and Tulsa on the 50th anniversary of Kristallnacht, that we marched down the street commemorating, the events that happened many years ago. But the Ku Klux Klan in our country was rampant for many, many years. There were rallies in New York City at Madison Square Garden. So it was all over the country. And what the ADL, with help of others, developed what was called an anti-mask law. And again, within the context of, you know, the Constitution permits you to be a bigot. What the law said, you want to be a bigot, fine. Take responsibility for it. Because the Klan flourished because during the day, these racist bigots, anti-Semites, during the day, they were doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs. They did whatever it is. And at night, they put on the hood to act out their bigotry. And once the law was passed, the anti-mask law, and we removed the mask, that you could not march or you could not act publicly with your identity hidden, it was the beginning of the end of the Klan. And to some extent, the Internet, which is so much a boon for education, information, interaction, is also, what I said before, a superhighway for bigotry. And it's like we put the mask back on the bigots. So now they can spout and sprout and flout their bigotry anonymously. You don't know who they are. They use pseudonyms. They use handles, whatever it is that they use. And it flourishes out there. And it incites and it intimidates. And so it's a new challenge. How do you take this boom to information education, which also so enhances the spread of anti-Semitism and racism and bigotry, and how do you contain it within the First Amendment?
Really, when you talk about the Internet, it's also about civility, too, because, I mean, that's you can write things on a post or a comment that you would never say to a person's face.
Right. Right, absolutely. Which is goes back to the Klan mask.
Yeah.
You know, with your face uncovered, you wouldn't act or do or say certain things, which under anonymity, you certainly are courageous enough to do or say.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you another question. If you see any connections, it sounds like you do, in the totality of events that we've seen against religious and ethnic minorities. You know, we've seen burning of black churches in Louisiana, shootings at a black church in Charleston, of course, the violence in Charlottesville, and of course, the terrible shooting in Pittsburgh, the Tree of Life Synagogue. Do you see any connections between all of those?
Yes,
you think it's you think it's just this?
Yeah,
first of all,
there's a breakdown of civility. And as I said, the taboos have been removed. Yeah, hate is related, and people who hate one person one day, another person another, and you, even when you look on their blogs, etc., you see the interaction of the object, the other, and it's whoever is the other, and the other. There are a lot of others who are not like to the white supremacist. Everybody who is not white is the other, and they can be Muslim, they can be Jewish, they can be Hispanic, they can be African American. It doesn't matter. That's the other object of hate. So, yeah, it does cross parallels. Sadly, when you read some of the hate manifestos that we've seen recently on the Internet after acts of horror and atrocity, you see how linked is this message of hate or this desire to hate the other. So, yeah, unfortunately, it is linked. The good news is that hopefully it will bring us together to stand together against it and not let each ethnic or racial or religious group fend for themselves.
I'd like to ask you about tribalism in American politics when it relates to issues of hate, of how one side will go after the other for statements or actions that do touch up to the boundary, cross the boundary into, you know, whether it's a anti-Semitic trope or Islamophobic comments, and the two parties seemingly will attack the other side for violations, but maybe not necessarily police their own side.
Well, that's part of the change that has occurred in the last couple of years, and also hate has been politicized. And so, you know, it becomes, you know, Democrats say Republicans are racist, Republicans say Democrats are racist, and that doesn't get us anywhere except into a shouting circle. Yeah, and that undermines the ability to stand together against it. And it's pretty serious because you don't deal with the hate, but you deal with, the political ramifications and the advantages you can take from it. And that undermines the ability to reduce it. It's easier to say it than to do it. But, standing up to say no when somebody's bullied, and we now know that more than half of the population somewhere along the line have been bullied. And the answer to bullying is one or two people who stand up and say, don't. Don't say that. Don't do that. And yet, the lack of the ability or the courage. So we say, stand up. It's not that easy. It's not that easy. But I think one needs to continue to preach and to encourage people to stand up to say no. You say no to an ethnic joke. You say no to insulting comments. But it's not always as easy as we say it is.
My guest today is Abraham Foxman, the National Director Emeritus of the Anti-Defamation League. He will be the guest speaker for the 22nd Annual Yom HaShoah Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration, which will take place Monday, May 6th at 7 o'clock at Temple Israel. One last question. I was reading an interview. You talked earlier about how, once you were reunited with your parents, you waited for several years to immigrate into the United States. And there was an interview that touched on immigration, which you said, for Jews around the world who've suffered discrimination or repression, there were two places that they could always immigrate to, Israel and the United States. And you expressed some concerns in this interview that maybe the United States is no longer that place.
Well, there is an issue of immigration, and we are changing laws, restrictions, amounts. The administration is trying to limit the amount of legal immigrants to, I think, 30,000 a year. Wow. That could make a major impact. Look, there were quotas. There were quotas against Jews in this country. Many more Jews would have survived the Holocaust if our doors were open. There was a ship called the St. Louis with a cargo of Jewish refugees that Hitler sent out, and America wouldn't take it. Dominican Republic took some, Cuba took some, but American doors were closed. But, changes occurred. We broke down the quotas, and we're back into quotas. We're back into restricting legal, and I'm not talking about illegal immigration. I'm talking about legal immigration is being restricted more and more. So, yeah, I worry about America, the land of the free, about Emma Lazarus and the Statue of Liberty saying to people all over the world, come. And I worry about Jews who, if they will face, they're going to decide that France is, they can't stay in France or Great Britain, et cetera. All right, thank God there's Israel, but there used to be two choices. I'm not sure there will be two choices.
Abraham Foxman, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Rich. Look forward to seeing you.
Abraham Foxman is the National Director Emeritus of the Anti-Defamation League. He spoke with us back in the middle of April, prior to the Poway Synagogue shooting this past Saturday. He'll be the guest speaker for the 22nd Annual Yom HaShoah Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration, coming up Monday evening at 7 o'clock at Temple Israel. He'll be speaking on Survival in the Shadows, Hidden Children of the Holocaust, but no doubt addressing the current climate of anti-Semitism in America today. For details on the commemoration, visit jewishtulsa.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.